Let's do it.
Out to the right. 5 seconds to go in the first half. Dante fires deep to the left. Moss caught it at the 11, but now he pitches
look at
it.
This.
Demole Williams! Touchdown!
You gotta be kidding me!
Of the Climbing the Pocket podcast. My name is Jason Brown. You can find me on Twitter at BrownJason. And I guess in a way you can say we have the whole crew. Got QB1 with me here. JR, what's going on, my man?
What's going on, man? Glad to be back.
And, you know, we have a little space, a little hole in the group right here with our man, wide receiver one, still off, having a great time, still on Twitter all the damn time, from the beach in Mexico, Miles Gorham. I'm gonna move it right along. Saxy Prince, what's going on, my man?
How y'all doing, man? I'm just chilling, doing what I gotta do. A little disappointed from this morning, to be perfectly honest. So I know everybody has heard, but Dave Chappelle was supposed to be coming through town next week, actually. And but I went online to get the tickets and stuff, and they were sold out like within like the first millisecond that it was there. So I was disappointed. Which brings me to my random question of the day.
But before you get into it, I'm just going to let you know that I was at my father's house yesterday, and my baby sister cursed me up and down about a random question from maybe two shows ago. We were talking about celebrity crushes. So if this week, if you could try to make the question something that's not going to get me yelled at the next time I'm with my family.
they shouldn't yell at you for this one. Who is y'all's favorite comedian all time, regardless of era, all that stuff? Mine is Dave Chappelle. I was so hyped to see him. I wanted to see him. He's been my favorite comedian since I can remember. I think he's a comedic genius, the way that he was able to weave together stories, push the envelope on controversial and political topics and social topics. So Dave Chappelle is mine. So who's y'all's?
Hey, QB1, you can go first.
My personal one, I think he's severely underrated. His name is Lavelle Crawford. He is hilarious. If you've never heard of him, look him up. He just tells his life stories. And I just like comedians that just tell their life stories. And he's just hilarious. He doesn't do much things that are funny, but the way he tells the stories is what makes it funny. And he just talks about his life and the stories of his life. If you never heard of him, please YouTube him. He will have you dying laughing. Lavelle Crawford, hilarious.
Okay. I'm going to have to go YouTube him too. I'm over here looking at him right now. Guess he was in Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates.
Breaking Bad.
He was an American Ultra, and that's about it. And for myself, I'd probably say Richard Pryor. So when I was in university, anytime we were on a road trip, my homeboy and I would just kind of go look in gas stations and try to find old Richard Pryor, either tapes or CDs or whatever, just to throw in to keep his company on the ride. And Richard Pryor, I feel like, set the kind of the archetype for the modern comedian. And so for me, it'd be Richard Pryor, faux show.
Jason always showing his age.
I am old and I am okay with it. With that, it's a perfect segue. We roll into a conversation about another old black man. OJ Simpson. Parole hearing.
That man.
Major on every network today. Folks mad for some reason. Like, OJ, for whatever reason with OJ, folks are still super intrigued. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I watched the documentary ESPN did. But, like, if you read the timeline, folks were right back in the moment, upset. What were your thoughts on just kind of the spectacle that was the OJ parole hearing? And, you know, what's next to come for the juice and all the drama that surrounded everything that happened to them?
I mean, I didn't have very much to say about it. I was at work when all this was happening. I got the updates and stuff. But I think folks are just in their feelings because, you know, a lot of folks wanted OJ to go to prison because they felt like he had committed the crime that he committed and whatnot. which I mean, they, you know, they have the right to feel the way that they are, but yeah, they just basically felt like this 9-year sentence wasn't enough for, you know, everything. So I think that's why folks were still in his feelings, even though basically he spent 9 years in prison for robbery, which is, you know, roughly, you know, on good behavior, that's roughly around the time you sometimes spend in prison. So they wanted him to get punished for something he did 20 years ago versus, you know, what he did now. So,
yeah, what were your thoughts on everything, JR?
You know, I actually watched it when it happened, and I didn't think they were going to free him just because OJ just was up there like he was talking to his homeboys. I was like, he got to bust out a tear, you know, just break out crying, something, show some sympathy. But you really didn't see that from OJ. He was just his same old self up there just talking like he was just telling a story. And I was surprised they let him go. But he'll find some way to get back in jail. That's my belief. That's just how OJ's been the past few years. And, I mean, it is what it is.
Yeah, I guess the wild thing for me about all this is as much as people talk about wanting justice, et cetera, I mean, with OJ and expecting him to be in jail forever for this particular crime, I mean, that's not justice. In this case, you're out for vengeance, and that's not what the system's supposed to do. I mean, OJ's sentence for this crime was heavy. And so you can't go, I mean, sentencing people after they, you know, beat another case on the next one. That's not how it's supposed to work. But it was just wild watching people on the timeline just get upset about all this, even though, I mean, the betting markets pretty much told us last week this is what was going to go down. Vegas had a line on OJ getting out, and so we should have known this is what was happening this week. The next one we're talking, next thing we need to talk about, because this is something that's I know is near and dear to Saxy's heart. We're talking about these running backs and how they're not getting paid enough money, how the position's been devalued. And so Le'Veon Bell's kind of come out a little bit here and saying that, you know, yeah, he got a lucrative offer from the Steelers, but in his view, it's not enough. Apparently, they were offering him about $12, $13 million a year, hefty amount of guaranteed money for a running back. And Lev Bell said, no, he needs to be paid not just like a running back, but needs to be paid like their second wide receiver, because that's essentially what he was in that offense. So I wanted to get your takes on the whole Le'Veon Bell situation as it pertains to him in particular. Like, should he have taken the money? And then what are your thoughts on kind of how the whole system works and how these contracts are set up? Should it be paid based on how a guy's used, or should you be pigeonholed into a contract amount based on what position you play? So we're talking about running backs. Prince is kind of synonymous with running backs now. So we'll start with you first, my man.
Yeah, you guys obviously know how I feel about the situation. I think I understand why the position in and of itself, the way that it was, I mean, you know, I would say the Adrian Peterson and prior era where running backs, you know, some of them primarily took the ball out of the dot, or, you know, they weren't as versatile as they are expected to be in today's day and age. In today's day and age, these guys are the running backs, they're wide receivers, some of them are fullbacks, they're offensive line men. I mean, the things that they're asked to do so consistently far exceeds what a lot of other players are being asked to do. And in the case of guys like Le'Veon Bell, David Johnson, you know, some other guys in the league who are producing at a really high level, I think, you know, we need to stop looking at all of their running back and versus like, oh, this is what they are to the team, so I need to value them as an important piece of the team. There are ways that you can find these guys to get open or to, you know, to have them have production. So especially in Le'Veon Bell's case, and obviously when David Johnson needs to sign his contract, like, I think these, you need to strip away that, oh, he plays running back, and look at him as like he's getting a lion's share of the production that's coming out of the team and whatnot. So I'm okay with paying by production and by usage and importance to the team.
So to that point, how do you deal with the, you know, the counter argument to someone like Le'Veon Bell, where they'll look at, you know, D'Angelo Williams going in there for 10 games in 2015 and putting up pretty big numbers, 4.5 yards per carry, you know, 9.2 yards a reception. In those 10 games, he put up, you know, almost 1,300 yards from scrimmage for him, I guess. What's your counter to someone saying that? Is it the system that makes Le'Veon Bell good, or could any running back go in there and produce? Like, I guess, how do you deal with that counterpoint?
Yeah, no, I've heard that counterpoint, that point often, like D'Angelo Williams could just step in. But let's not forget, D'Angelo Williams, he is still a good player. I think he was slightly underutilized at Carolina because he brought in Cam Newton, and he could do a lot in that Carolina system.
But he's cheap, though. I guess it's not a matter of good or not good. I mean, I guess that's the point, is that you can find a guy like D'Angelo Williams, who's 32 years old, can still play, but he's cheap. Why would you pay Le'Veon Bell $13 million?
I guess my counter argument to that is I think D'Angelo Williams at 32 years old is still cheap, but for the next, you know, 3-4 years, he's not. I don't foresee him being able to keep up the level of production that he did last year. And like I said, I think D'Angelo Williams is a little bit underrated because of what he was used back in Carolina. So as far as Le'Veon Bell, I think this is less of a slight on Le'Veon Bell, and it's more speaking to, yes, a part of the system, and also D'Angelo Williams. D'Angelo Williams is a good player, and not paying Le'Veon Bell doesn't necessarily equate to, oh, well, we can just bring in anybody and the system's going to be working well. Because D'Angelo Williams is a good player. I think he fit the system that they have. But I think Le'Veon Bell, I think he, what's the word I'm looking for? He is, I think he improves the system. I think because of his skill sets, he makes the system even better because of what he can contribute to it. Whereas I think someone like D'Angelo Williams does a really good job complementing the system, which is why you saw the production that he had.
That's fair. And JR, we know that you are a huge proponent of Le'Veon Bell. You've been singing his praises for some time. He was your first pick in this dynasty draft we just finished up, or in the process of finishing up. So what are your thoughts on how this whole thing is going and where Le'Veon Bell is at with his contract demands?
I mean, obviously it's always a negotiating tactic, and Von Miller really started all of this, because it's the whole, is he a defensive end, is he an outside linebacker debate, and obviously defensive ends are getting paid a lot more than outside linebackers, and on the depth chart, he's listed as an outside linebacker just because of their 3-4 scheme, but Von Miller wanted to be listed as a defensive end, obviously because they get paid a lot more, so it's really a negotiating tactic with Le'Veon Bell as well, in my opinion, because obviously receivers are getting paid a ton more than running backs. And, you know, I copied you guys in a tweet the other day where kickers are actually getting more guaranteed money than running backs. And I know Yinka felt some type of way about that because he's a running back advocate. But I think it's a smart tactic by Le'Veon Bell because, you know, I'm always in favor of the players maximizing their value just because of the NFL owners make so much off these players and off these franchises. And I'm always in favor of the players getting their money as long as they've proven their worth in their time. And I feel like Le'Veon Bell has proven his worth. I wish he would have taken the contract that they offered him just because I don't see him getting that type of money on the open market. And I don't know if they're willing to offer him that contract again, even if he does repeat his success. So I'm always in favor of guys maximizing their value. And I kind of think he missed his opportunity with this contract he just passed up.
So you raised a good point when you're talking about Von Miller right there. And it's kind of, I guess, it's kind of the same point where Von Miller basically is a defensive end. I mean, he's rushing the passer on every play. But then you got a guy who plays 3-4 defensive end, who's really a D tackle, but potentially would get paid like a defensive end if he needed to get franchised. Or you have, you know, a David Johnson, Le'Veon Bell playing running back versus, say, a guy who played more, you know, we'll say old school, traditional Adrian Peterson type running back. Like, should we move ourselves away from a place where it's just, this is the position you play, so this is what your, you know, your contracts should be, or your franchise tag should be? Like, should those things be updated to kind of fit what the modern NFL looks like? And I'll start with you, JR, on this one.
Like I said, it always goes back to negotiating. And I think Von Miller really started something, because guys are going to stop being labeled as something that they're really not. I'm not saying Von Miller is not an outside linebacker, but he gets paid to rush the passer. And that's what defensive ends do. Let's just be real. He's not getting paid to drop in coverage and cover guys on passing downs. He's getting paid to rush the passer. And I mean, he won Denver a Super Bowl by doing it. And just a random example, Michael Vick rushed for 1,000 yards, and running backs were getting paid back then. So should he Should he have went to the negotiating table as a running back instead of a quarterback? Just little examples like that. And it'll be interesting to see how players adjust to this stuff in the future. And do they start labeling themselves something that they're really not, even though their stats show that they're something or a different position? So we'll see. We know David Johnson's coming up for a contract extension here soon. So will he use that same negotiating tactic that Le'Veon does? Or, you know, David seems like a more humble guy than what Le'Veon is. But, you know, I'm all about guys maximizing their worth. And, you know, they should be too. So we'll see.
Yinka, did you have a follow-up point on that?
Yeah, I did. I think it's kind of akin to what happened in the NBA. I mean, we used to – back in the 80s, 90s, we used to have so much centered around, you know, your point guard was this, your shooting guard was this, small forward, power forward, center, all this. And now the roles have become very ambiguous. Now you're having, you know, power forwards and centers who can handle the ball just as good as some of these point guards out here. And I think that's what you're seeing with the NFL is hybrids are becoming way more common than we like to think. Like I said before, running backs have to be more versatile for what the league is now. So I think because of that evolution is the exact reason why I've said before, not to devalue the position, but if anything, to start to value it a little bit more because, you know, for guys like Le'Veon Bell, guys like David Johnson, guys like, I think, Dalvin Cook in the future, I think those guys you're going to start seeing how big of an impact they can actually have for a team if utilized correctly. Both schematically and both maximizing what they do well.
I'm glad you didn't say guys like Adrian Peterson because, you know, that would have just been a little too much. But, you know, let's you know, use my shot at Adrian Peterson to transition into another aged running back playing in what should be a good offense, Mr. Frank Gore. So someone tweeted today that Frank Gore needs 620 yards to pass LaDainian Tomlinson for fifth all-time in rushing in NFL history, which kind of prompted the question that we had kind of back and forth in the DM today. Is Frank Gore a Hall of Fame player to you guys? JR, I'll start with you.
Absolutely. Without question, in my opinion, probably one of the most underrated careers in NFL history, in my opinion. He's like the Phillip Rivers of running backs, just because I feel like Phillip Rivers is a guy that career has been vastly underrated. I tweeted that out the other day just because he's been around bad teams a lot of the latter part of his career. You know, he really hasn't had any shining moments since the Marty Schottenheimer and North Turner days, but ever since then it's just been a downward spiral. And I think Frank Gore has really been a product of that as well. He had some shining moments with the 49ers, and you know, he's put good seasons together with the Colts. I don't have his stats right here in front of me, but he's been a productive runner. And he hasn't been a guy that's just been in a downward spiral. He's been steady his whole career. And his career's been really underrated as a versatile guy.
Yinka, you on the same page as JR there? Frank Gore, a Hall of Famer for you?
Yeah, I definitely have Frank Gore as a Hall of Famer. I know that he was never number one at his position, really, I don't think in any year, but I think he was pretty consistently within that top five conversation. And I think that's an important part to look at it because of the consistency and, you know, the level of production he's had over the course of his year or over the course of his career for so long.
I guess I'll be the odd person out here. I don't know. This is a tough one for me because, I mean, he does have some seasons in there just kind of glancing at him right now where, yeah, he had some great efficiency numbers, put up some great overall numbers, but I don't know. For me, I guess when I think of the NFL Hall of Fame versus like the NBA Hall of Fame, like the NBA Hall of Fame, basically if you were good for a couple of years or made a couple of all-star teams, they let you into the Hall of Fame. Whereas the NFL, they make it a far more exclusive club. They make it more difficult to get in. And I guess if it's going to be an exclusive club, when I look at it, I'd rather see the guys who were, you know, those top players in the game who were getting first team all pro when they were playing that were the best at their position over, you know, the period of time that they were in the game versus the guys who are just kind of in it for the long haul. Like when I'm looking at Frank Gore now in Indianapolis, and part of that's their their offensive line. But I mean, the last two seasons, 3.7 yards per carry, 3.9 yards per carry. Like, he's just out there not getting hurt, getting a lot of touches, compiling stats. But I mean, I don't know. It's just not impressive. It's not as impressive to me when guys rack up a bunch of yards just by playing a really, really long time versus the guys who come in. I guess it goes back to that Jerry Rice, Randy Moss conversation. Like, who's the greatest wide receiver of all time? If I'm picking a team, I'm picking Randy Moss. Even though, you know, Jerry Rice has all the records because he played for a longer period of time. I want that dominant guy making the wild plays versus the guy who was just out there grinding for 20-plus seasons. I guess anyone have any final thoughts on that before we move on? Yank, I looked like you were waving your hand, but you might have just been moving your phone.
Yeah, I was just waving. I mean, I think we'll get into it a little bit deeper in a second, so I'll wait. I'll hold off.
Okay. All right. And JR, how about you? I guess when you're thinking about, you know, Hall of Fame, what's your personal criteria? I've said mine. I want, like, you know, the Randy Moss type players if I'm picking for Hall of Fame. I guess when you're looking at, you know, Hall of Fame, if you had to come up with a quick blurb describing, you know, what you'd be looking for the Hall of Famer, for a Hall of Fame player, if you had a vote, what would that be for you?
When I always think about that, a Hall of Famer, how did they transcend the game, or what did they do? That's my biggest theory in, you know, proving if a guy is a Hall of Famer or not. Is Frank Gore a first ballot guy? I don't think so. I think it'll take him a while to get in, but just off stats alone, I think he'll get in just because, you know, he was underrated, but he put up some serious numbers and they're still ongoing. I'm not sure what year this is for him, but he's been very productive every year he's been in the NFL. So I think the biggest criteria for me when looking at a Hall of Fame guy is what way or how did they transcend the game and what was their lasting impact.
Okay, how about you, Yinka?
Yeah, I think JR had an interesting point as far as, and then maybe this plays more into why you and I maybe don't see eye on this point, is I think when we talk about first ballot Hall of Famers, I think that's when I'm looking at those guys who are not only transcend the game, but their level of production was just so high. Maybe not for a long period of time, but for a time that was literally changing the way that the league was constructed because they were so dominant for even for a short period of time, like the Randy Mosses, you know. But I guess when I look at it in a broad sense, I also look at it as, you know, I look at we always look at it at the league, but also how it affected the team. You know, we have a lot of teams that did not do well, but, you know, we have some players who produced at a very high level. And I don't necessarily like penalizing players for their production to be at a really high level versus and it not really being able to shine through because, again, your team is continually, you know, falling at the very, very bottom. I had an example or two, but it's escaping me right now. But I do think there's a few players who probably will make in the Hall of Fame who, I mean, has the San Diego Chargers really been that great or LA Chargers been that great for the last, you know, 6-7 years? Probably not. But I think Phillip Rivers, I would say he's a Hall of Famer. Obviously because of production, but at the same time, I think he's played at a very, very high level. And I think he's underrated sometimes, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's tough for Phillip Rivers. I mean, he came in, if you look at the other guys he was drafted with, I mean, they've won championships, right? So he gets overlooked in some degree because even though he's played well, he plays on the West Coast, but he's also was drafted with guys who have multiple Super Bowls. So that, I mean, yeah, that's always going to be tough for him. But it also, you know, takes us in, you know, talk about quarterbacks, Phillip Rivers. We get to talk now about Yinka's least favorite position on the field, the quarterback position. And I guess, did you guys see the rankings that ESPN came out with the greatest quarterbacks of the modern era, where they went back and brought together a panel of people with a ton of coaching experience to, you know, kind of rate, in their opinion, the top quarterbacks of all time? And you got little blurbs from each of the coaches explaining why they chose who they chose. And so ESPN went in and said that Tom Brady, Peyton Manning, Joe Montana, John Elway, and Aaron Rodgers were their top five quarterbacks of the modern era. And so QB1, obviously, this is your topic. We'll start with you on this one. What are your thoughts on kind of what they had to say about quarterbacks, and do you agree with the five that they have in there?
Yeah, I agree. You know, some of the qualities that they listed in the blurbs that they had really good reasoning behind them, in my personal opinion. I think it's a tight race between Tom Brady and Peyton Manning. Those are my two personal favorites. And I actually like Peyton Manning more than Tom Brady, and I'll explain why. Tom Brady is the greatest quarterback who ever lived, and he's also the most accomplished quarterback to ever live. But as far as being a total commander of the game and being responsible for the entire operation, I think Peyton Manning is the best who ever did it, just because he was always in control of the game, and he always seemed like he was a step ahead. And people always give me crap when I say this, but if Peyton Manning had the defenses that Tom Brady had, I think he would have at least 4 rings. That's just my opinion. When you go and just think about Peyton Manning's defenses, you can't hardly name anybody that was on it besides Robert Mathis and Dwight Freeney and Bob Sanders for the 2 to 3 years that he did play. He was healthy in. But if you think about the defenses that Tom Brady had, they were stacked from the front line all the way to, you know, back deep with the safeties. You talk about guys like Richard Seymour, Willie McGinnis, Vince Wilfork. Then you go to the linebackers, Teddy Bruschi. Then you go on the back end, you go with Ty Law, Rodney Harrison, guys like that. So Tom Brady had really good defenses. And, you know, I just think if Peyton Manning had those type of defenses all throughout his prime, I think he would have at least 4 rings. But those are my 2 favorite guys, Tom Brady and Peyton Manning.
So with a guy like Peyton Manning, with as much of a control freak as he's described as, and with as much influence as he had, you know, on that organization, you'd imagine, why would you think that they would keep adding kind of weapons for Peyton early? Because it seemed, I mean, if you look at the weapons that Peyton played with for the majority of his career, guys like Reggie Wayne, Marvin Harrison, et cetera, like Peyton had some, it seemed that they just kept loading up on the offensive side of the ball when they had Peyton Manning. I guess, why do you think that would be the case, given that, you know, the defense was the thing that needed the most help when he was there?
Well, we're kind of seeing it with Aaron Rodgers right now. You know, Peyton was so good that he could mask the deficiencies of the entire team. And we see Aaron Rodgers, he has subpar help. You know, he has Jordy Nelson, Randall Cobb, Devontae Adams. Those guys are starting to come around. Jordy's been a good player for him. Randall Cobb was really good early on in his career, but he's kind of leveled off now. But, you know, having guys that's so good, it kind of makes teams get lazy and stacking their personnel, just because those guys are so good, they can help overcome the talent that they have, you know, on offense and defense. And we saw a catch up to the Packers in the NFC Championship game last year against the Falcons. You know, they just didn't have the talent to beat those guys. And we saw that with Peyton Manning, where he couldn't get over the hump against Tom Brady for years, but he finally did. So it's a very similar situation where teams just, they just forget to add depth on one side of the ball. And, you know, those guys are so great that they can master deficiencies for teams for so long, but they kind of fail to get over the hump because those guys can only do so much.
Yinka, where are you at with it? So I guess first question, do you agree with the top 5 that they laid out there with Brady, Manning, Montana, Elway, and Rodgers? And if not, I guess, how would you switch that up?
Yeah, I actually took I didn't have Elway on it. I did have – my list was Brady, Manning, Rodgers, Montana, and Favre. And this is why I had the – as far as reason. I think Miles touched on it – or not Miles, but JR touched on it before. The reason why I picked these quarterbacks is because I think that they revolutionized the game in their own very specific way. I think as far as Joe Montana, we saw like kind of the guy, cold-blooded, win-it-all type guys, you know, won multiple Super Bowls, same as Tom Brady in my way. But Tom Brady was a little bit different because he was such a perfectionist. And that I think that mentality you've seen in some other players and wanting to role model their game after that. I think Peyton Manning is pretty obvious. I mean, I think he changed the way the game was played pre-snap and all the things that he did, you know, before you even snap the ball and really getting people to understand that, like, you know, throwing the football is one of the last things that is your job as a quarterback. You know, it's everything else that you're doing, all the preparation that you're doing beforehand. And then I put Brett Favre in there, not necessarily because from a production standpoint, unfortunately, because you guys know how I feel about Brett Favre. I think that he's been good for the game, but he's been terrible for the game just because I think he's become a poor role model for what we think that a prototypical quarterback should be, you know, the big arm, the, you know, the gunslinging attitude, all that stuff. But I think the level in which Brett Favre loved the game and improvised so much, I think it did improve. I think it did change the way that a lot of some quarterbacks play. You know, some quarterbacks who aren't too bright, who have some very natural gifts, and they somewhat transcended the game because they just relied on their physical tools to be able to get them constantly over the hump and have a little bit of improvisation to the game.
Did you just call Brett Favre slow? Because it felt like you just called Brett Favre slow. Is that what just happened?
He was not the smartest quarterback, okay? He didn't even know what nickel defense was for the longest time, so.
I am shocked that you, as a jazz-playing musician, would equate the fact that Brett Favre maybe wasn't as book-learned as him being less intelligent when improvisation is such a big part of what it is that you love so much.
But yeah, no, I'm saying I'm not that, you know how I feel. There's two types of genius. Obviously, there is the book smart, the guys who just have a highly logical mind. And I think there's another side of intelligence. There's the creative mind that's able to just, you know, they're able to just weave things together at the highest level. So I do give credit to Brett Favre in that respect. That's why I actually put him on the list, because he was really creative. He was a guy that, you know, he likes to break the rules more often than not when he probably shouldn't have. And it got him in trouble a lot. And at the same time, we saw some really great games because of it. But that's what kind of why I would put him on the list, less from a production standpoint and more from a he did revolutionize the game in a way.
Okay, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to clear that up, because I know that you weren't really calling Brett Favre slow. You were just saying that he's smart in a different way. And for me, I think I'd go a little bit different than both you guys. I'm going with Brady, Montana, going with Peyton Manning, then Dan Marino and Aaron Rodgers. For myself, I think that Dan Marino, for some of the same reasons we were mentioning with Philip Rivers, is often overlooked when we have these conversations. But when Marino was playing, he was so cold. Marino was so good and so ahead of his time. And if he played, I think, in the league with the rules set up the way they are right now, Marino would be out here just killing fools with the talents that he had when he came in. So Marino was the guy that I put in there that probably wouldn't be in most people's top five. But there was another person on the list that I wanted to just get y'all's opinion on real quick. So they had Drew Brees at number 9 overall. And so they had Drew Brees at number 9 ahead of guys like, you know, Ben Roethlisberger, Warren Moon, Dan Fouts, and some other guys like that. And so I wanted to get your thoughts on that. JR, we'll start with you, and kind of, is that a deserved position for Drew Brees? Should he be that high up on the list?
I would say yes, just because that's tough. Yeah, I would say he should, because Drew Brees is a phenomenal talent to me. He's been in terrible situations in New Orleans outside of the 1 year that they won in 2009, I believe it was. Never been surrounded by a good defense, even when they won the Super Bowl that one season. I don't believe their defense was that overly great, but he's just been very similar to Phillip Rivers in that he's been in awful situations. I don't remember how good his defenses were in San Diego, but that was early on in his career. But he's a guy that really hasn't had the talent that those other guys have been surrounded with, offensively or defensively. So, you know, QB wins isn't a stat, of course, as everybody reiterates all the time, but I think he's just been a guy that's been stuck in a bad situation, but he's always been great with the OC that he's had, which is Sean Payton. So those two guys are really a match, but the defensive coordinators that Sean Payton has had have just been bad, been very, very bad. And I don't think we should really hold that against Drew Brees as a quarterback, because, I mean, it really doesn't symbolize who he is, wins and losses, as far as his actual performance, because I think he's phenomenal. I think he's a great quarterback. So I think 9 is fair.
Okay, how about you, Saxy? What are your thoughts on Drew Brees at number 9?
Yeah, I would have to agree with JR. I haven't ranked the top quarterbacks, but I find it very hard to not put Drew Brees in the top 10, just because, I mean, he really has had – he's a definition of really not getting very much help. And the level of play that he's able to – you know, he was able to do – for a very, very long time, including the Super Bowl run. I think that's what's underrated. I've always loved Drew Brees' accuracy, I've always loved how he's, you know, he's kind of become that sample of a guy who comes in, you know, the scouts say, you know, he doesn't have that great of an arm. And then he just, you know, works his butt off and he becomes, you know, a guy who can throw the ball down the field, a guy who can cut you up in the middle, a guy who makes, for the most part, makes very, very good decisions. And, you know, sometimes I always try to take a player that I really like and take them out of their situation and maybe put them in a more ideal situation. You know, what would Drew Brees be like if he played, you know, what Drew Brees would be like if he played in Minnesota or Green Bay or, you know, New England or something that I think was a little bit more ideal than, you know, what he's been in New Orleans.
All right. And he would be the same in Green Bay because their defense is also hot garbage. But Minnesota, I mean, if he wants to come on through and help us win some, you know, I guess we'll take him.
Kirk Cousins, baby.
For who? For what? Kirk Cousins.
Ain't that the rumor y'all started yesterday?
Don't do that. We can't handle that. We can't have sleeves versus glove versus you like that or some other nonsense. We can't do it.
You said like, y'all, JR. Like, I was included in this. Nope.
No, there was like an ESPN article that had like destinations or suitors for Kirk Cousins in 2018, and Minnesota made the list.
Which is crazy. And I guess, you know, we'll have this aside just real, real quick. But man, like, Bradford gets no respect at all from anyone ever. Like, he's here. He's the starting quarterback. He's healthy. And ESPN's putting out articles talking about Kirk Cousins coming here next year. The team is using, hey, 5 days till training camp. Did we have some for 8 days for training camp? I don't know. I don't remember. Why everyone disrespecting Sam all the time?
He's the forgotten older sibling.
All the time. All the time. Sam wanted that for Christmas. Why you got to get that for the younger sibling?
Right. Here's part of the reason why people disrespect Sam Bradford so much. And me and Arif on the Football Machine talked about it yesterday. Sam Bradford does a lot of things well. He does a lot of things well. Actually better than some people do. His first down efficiency is actually very, very good compared to other guys in the league. The problem comes with Sam. I mean, we know he has the physical tools. If he were to use the physical tools that he has to the fullest extent, you would see a much, much better quarterback. The problem always lies with his third down efficiency. Third and long, like, Sam Bradford is horrific. Go look at the stats. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's his third and long efficiency is not great. So when you want to put up the third and long efficiency against all these other things that he seemingly does do well, you have to ask yourself, is it enough to get you over that hump to, you know, get into the playoffs? And then once you get into the playoffs, to win you a couple games, and once you win a couple games, to actually bring you that Super Bowl. And that's why Sam Bradford doesn't get you very much love. He's never made the playoffs. And even when he seems like he's going to get close, you know, the issues that he has start to creep up. And you have to ask yourself, are you willing to maybe take away some of the other physical traits that he has, things that he does well better than other people, to improve the area that he or area or areas that he doesn't do very well? So that's why I think Bradford doesn't get as much love as he should.
The quote from Zimmer today was hilarious. I don't know if y'all read Brian Murphy's article from the Pioneer Press when he's talking about Teddy and Sam. He said, I love Teddy, but I like Sam too. Kind of like he just shrugging it off. I just thought that was kind of funny. But, you know, I'm not trying to start no controversy or anything like that, but I just thought that was a funny quote.
Yeah, it was a funny quote. And also in there where he kind of hints at the fact that, you know, like, Sam has all the physical gifts, but Teddy wins and makes the plays at the end of games. And that's kind of one of the things that I think Yinka was just alluding to, is that, you know, in those tighter situations to date, and it's not to say that he never can, to date, Sam isn't the guy who consistently has come through for his entire career. And the hope is, and Emery was also talking about this a little bit on the pod that we had him on, is that you can design an offense where you minimize the situations like that for Sam. So Sam is very good. And I think that's some of the frustration that I had with the offense. It seemed that Zimmer wanted to run and the quarterback that we have in Sam Bradford, So if you have a quarterback like Sam who is good on first down, who makes smart decisions in the red zone and things like that, let him do those things. So I'd rather have Sam Bradford throw on first and second down and then maybe have Dalvin Cook get us the first down on third when we're facing third and short versus run when everyone knows we're going to run on first, run when everyone knows we're going to run on second, and then we have Sam facing, you know, a third and medium or third and long in a situation that he's just throughout his career not demonstrated the ability to do well in. Why not try to design an offense where we switch it up and keep him out of those situations, spread him out, let him throw the ball in more favorable situations, let him throw the ball in the red zone where we were ninth in red zone success rate last year. We were 17th, I believe, in red zone rushing success, but we ran the ball all the time in the red zone. Like, let Sam cook.
That's good. Good pun. And I think that speaks to why why you saw the Vikings. The offensive coordinator needs to do better this year, right? Pat Sermon needs to. We had everything flip flop, right? We were passing when we should be running the football. We were running when we should be passing the football. If you use Sam Bradford on first down, you've already improved the efficiency of your offense more than people think that they are. Sam Bradford's first down efficiency is actually pretty good. Again, like I said, the problem comes when you start getting into the third and long situations. We didn't have a run game last season. So what we try to do is pound the ball all the time on first down. And then the third down, expecting Sam, who arguably has a atrocious third and long situation, for a guy that he has never been situation. So what we have to do to start to maximize this offense just comes strictly from play calling and play design. Put Sam in the gun on first down more often than not and let him go to work on first down and even second down from time to time. But if you're in a situation where it's third and long, are we going to have to expect Sam to sometimes deliver on third and long? Yeah, absolutely. Third and seven, third and eight, you're going to have to do it. But if we're consistently not getting a yard for first and second down, and now it's third and 10, we're expecting Sam, who more often than not is not going to produce at that level. He's going to check the ball down. I think that's where we need to start improving and start seeing a little bit more just using our heads as far as common sense.
Yep. And to the point that you just raised, I was looking at it while you were talking right there. And yeah, we had a top 10 passing offense from a success rate standpoint in 2016 in the games that Sam played, while we were just kind of a middle of the pack team from a success rate standpoint. We were trying to run the ball in those situations. So hopefully the team is going back and doing that self-scouting and taking a look at these things, because I think you can, with the physical ability Sam has, design an offense in which he can be successful. It's just, you know, how far are you going to go with that offense once you actually do, say, get to the playoffs when all the teams you're facing are good? I think you can design an offense with Sam that can make us very good, you know, throughout the regular season, especially with the defense that we're facing or scheduled to face in 2017. It's just once we get down to crunch time and teams start to understand what it is we want to do and start taking those things away, then I think the real test would come. But it's just, yeah, it's funny to me. Kirk Cousins, they're already kind of penciling Sam to be moved and shipped to another place all over again when the dude had his best season ever last season. So I just thought that was a little funny. I guess any final words, JR, since you did kind of take us off on this tangent a little bit, bringing Kirk Cousins to this discussion?
It's a big year for Pat Shermer. If he has another bad year this year, I'm not sure if he'll survive it. And you know who's going to be the next offensive coordinator at the Minnesota Vikings?
Chip Kelly.
Jay Gruden.
Oh, Lord. Do you think Jay Gruden's getting fired?
Yeah.
Man, okay. Well, we have to come back to this one.
It's a circus up there in Washington. That's a hot take. Complete burn down in Washington after this season.
But the offense is the only good thing they have in Washington, and that's Jay Gruden.
They're going to burn it down.
All right. Well, since JR is providing us all this fodder for hot takes today, JR, you put out there our usual kind of Twitter poll, Twitter question. So I'll let you really set the stage in large part because I don't remember all the quarterbacks you included on your list. But you set a stage out there in terms of, you know, how folks would rank certain quarterbacks, or I think the last three or four draft classes. So with that, JR, take it away. I guess what was the question? And then give us your ranks before we get into things.
Yeah, so I put up a question the other day, just a random question that always comes to my head. I know I tweet a lot, and just random things always come to my head for whatever reason.
Out here tweeting when he should be picking in the draft. I mean, you know, got to say that. Out here have us waiting for 4 and 5 hours while you tweeting about mashed potatoes and quarterbacks. But, you know, I'm sorry. Go ahead, man. Go ahead.
Side note, man, these mashed potatoes are amazing. Go get them if you haven't already. But anyway, moving on to the question. So the question of the day was, if Jameis Winston, Marcus Mariota, Teddy Bridgewater, before he was injured, Derek Carr, Jared Goff, Blake Bortles, and Carson Wentz were all in this upcoming 2018 draft, how would you have them ranked on your draft board? So this is not to say what you've seen from them already in the NFL. Basically, how they were pre-draft, how would you have them ranked? So I had it, Mariota, Bridgewater, Winston, Carr, Goff, Wentz, and Bortles. That's how I had mine. Now, ironically, it would be the same exact order if, well, post-draft, it would be the same exact order based off what we've seen to this point. There was a lot of hot takes on this on Twitter, and it's interesting seeing the different opinions of everyone, especially those biased fans out there. I know a lot of people had Bridgewater at the top, which they shouldn't at all. And, you know, the Eagles fans, they're very emotional. They had Carson Wentz at the top of their list, and they felt offended by a lot of people that had him at that, you know, bottom dweller spot with Jared Goff and Blake Bortles. But, I mean, right now, Bortles and Goff are really the bottom of the barrel of the list right now, just because if we're talking about post-draft, off of what they've shown to this point, you know, Jared Goff, I think, well, I won't say he will, but he should improve with McVay there now. He, you know, he's a more offensive oriented guy instead of Rob Boers now, who's moved on to Buffalo. And, you know, McVay has a very quarterback friendly system, so Goff should excel in that. Blake Bortles is Blake Bortles at this point. I don't think there's really much improving going on there. They say they want to run the ball with Leonard Fournette, but I don't really see him making that big of a jump. I love Marcus Mariota, and it's just funny seeing a lot of people that don't really watch Marcus Mariota and how underrated he really is. I know somebody put up a stat the other day where he has 33 touchdowns to 0 interceptions in his career in the red zone. And I think that's just a remarkable stat. And Jason is over here giving the stank face right now because he doesn't seem like a Marcus Mariota fan.
No, right? I'm sorry. So when Yinka was talking about Sam Bradford and I started looking up success rate stats, I stayed on the page while you were going through all that, and I started looking at Minnesota on other downs and distances. And so the stank face wasn't about Marcus Mariota. He's probably my number one when you get back to me. The stank face was looking at our success rate as a team trying to run the ball on second down last year. And it was real, real, real bad. So on second down last year, Minnesota ranked 25th in the NFL in success rate when trying to run the ball. And we ranked 5th in passing the ball. Yet still, like, the ratio in run to pass, we did pass more than we ran, but the ratio was still way too close with the variance between those two outcomes being so high. 25th. In success rate trying to run the ball on second down. That is embarrassing.
Yeah, that's bad.
Yeah, sorry about that. So, no, I love Marcus Mariota. He's my number one, but continue.
Nah, go ahead. You got your list going, so go ahead. Jump right in the spotlight.
All right, so let me go ahead and look at these folks again. So if it was me and there was no injury, going Marcus Mariota, Teddy, Jameis, Carr, Wentz, Goff, and Bortles. I don't know. We flip a coin to figure out where it lands. I have a tough time. I probably put Bortles ahead of Goff just because Bortles knows where the sun comes up, I think. So that'll give him the edge for me. But yeah, it's tough. Like, yeah, all those guys are really close. Teddy going in, and this is pre-draft, you know, pre him coming to Minnesota. For me, once I started, you know, kind of amateur scouting players and going on draft breakdown and looking at guys like that, Teddy, I mean, he checked all the boxes in terms of the intangibles for me. So he was up there. Mariota, initially, I wasn't sold on him, but then I started getting into the, you know, the metrics plus what he was doing on the field. That's what puts him all the way at the top. So yeah, Marcus number one, Bridgewater, because it's the efficiency that they had. Winston, he gets the nod over Carr just based on just the intangibles that he brings to the table. Carr, good prospect, good pro, but still a little something missing for me in terms of what I've seen from him on the field in bowl settings. So in college, I was a little bit nervous about, you know, how nervous he seemed to get when he was, you know, in the pocket, and how he did seem to, you know, get those happy feet when things weren't necessarily as clean as they needed to be in the pocket. So that's why I would put Jameis over him for talking, you know, pre-draft ranking. Wentz, I mean, I don't think he's very good, but I think he's better than Goff and Bortles. And then, you know, Bortles, Goff, I mean, nah, I just don't think either of them are that good, but Bortles gets the nod because Goff seemed completely lost. Yinka, how about you, man?
Well, I mean, I think, Jason, you raised the point as far as Mariota. Yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of Mariota when I kind of did some, you know, amateur scouting as well. So that's why I had, you know, pre-draft, I would have Teddy above Mariota. So I think mine would be Teddy, Mariota, Winston, Carr, Bortles, and like you said, just really toss a coin between Goff and Wentz, but I'd probably put Goff over Wentz. But like, as far as Teddy, the reason why I liked him so much is I kept watching like his 2013 season, and there was the amount of accuracy that I saw out of him as a quarterback is what made me fall in love with him. Constantly getting hit, getting back up, making throws in the very, very tight windows, command of the system, leadership. Like, those are all things that I saw as far as its intangibles, and I didn't quite see them with Mariota as far as, you know, how he's going to handle the pro system. I thought Teddy was going to transition very well, whereas I didn't think Mariota was going to transition as well right away, but I wasn't really down on him, so.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. So with that said, I mean, we've got all of JR's questions out of the way. I think we're done with the hot takes. JR, training camp's around the corner. And I know that you started a bit of work on some stuff. So I guess we wanted to get your thoughts, I guess, on what you have kind of upcoming, if there's anything that we should be looking out for. And I guess if you had any specific training camp thoughts or previews or anything that you wanted to get out there before we wrap this one up tonight.
Yeah, so on Sunday, well, I'll just probably wait till Monday since that'll be the official first day of the work week. I'll go ahead and release just some of the biggest training camp questions that face the Vikings going forward. It'll be 8 major questions, and I'll go into detail about each and every one and how they potentially can answer each question that is on the list, and just, you know, address some other things as well, and just some of my thoughts on training camp, some position battles that's been ongoing. I'm sorry for the delay on that. I'll make sure I finish up all that stuff. But, you know, like I told y'all in the group meet, well, in the DMs the other day, that training camp kind of excites me, but the thing that really excites me is the preseason games. Just you finally get to see how the young guys finally adjust, and you kind of get an idea of how the coordinators are going to use certain guys. And I know Bucky Hodges is your guy. He'll probably, Jason, he'll be coming in around the second or third quarter just to see how Shermer uses him. And, you know, if I see him put his hand in the dirt and getting a 3-point stance, I'm going to go crazy just because that's not what he does. I want to see him flexed out wide and some other ways that they're going to use him as well. I'm really interested to see that second team offensive line too. You know, it'll be Pat Elflein, Isadora, Rashad Hill, guys along that line and that tier, just to see how much they've gotten better and how, you know, how they adjust to the speed of the game. So those are just a couple of tidbits that I'll be looking out for.
Awesome. And Saxy Prince, what do you have on deck for us? What you working on? I know that you're still making your way through the depth chart series, I guess. What's on deck for us in terms of work from Saxy Prince?
Yeah, I think Linebackers comes out tomorrow, and then I think I'll hop back to I think Linebackers will come out tomorrow, and I think that might be almost it, and then I think I might do some special teams type stuff. But I'll like I said, I'll be on I'll be around. I'll be on the field for the for training camp on the night practice. So I'll try to get some few interviews with some players. You know, I'll have a bunch of content that comes out there. Some stuff for the site. So yeah, you can look out for that.
If you get Bucky Hodges, it has to go on our site too.
Oh, for sure. If you for get sure. Bucky, my question is going to be like, my question is, Bucky, I have a very close personal friend of mine who has said that you are basically Bucky Gronkowski. How do you feel about that?
And he would tell you that your friend was a very, very smart person.
So I got a random question for y'all. Just popped in my head.
Okay.
So the Teddy situation, do you think they should have a press conference on the first day of training camp, or should they just let him stay quiet?
I answered this yesterday. The question actually was, is Teddy going to at least be available for the media? I think they'll let Teddy have one day in front of the media, and it'll probably be a few minutes. He's answered a few questions. He'll give the very Teddy-like, you know, I'm just doing it for the team. The team's all that's important, all that other stuff. But I don't think there's going to be no press conferences. I think they'll let him finally out of the – you know, of the dark cave that they put him in. But yeah,
I mean, I don't know. I kind of hope not. Like, I think they should address the Teddy situation. I think they should. I mean, we all want to see Teddy out front, but the way I'm at with it is Teddy shouldn't play this year. Teddy should be out rehabbing. I think that they should handle Teddy the way that, you know, they handled Adrian Peterson when he was coming back, where he was there, but he wasn't really there. He was a guy who was working out, and while he was working out and while he was still not practicing, we didn't really get to talk to him all that much. You know, he was off doing rehab. And I think that they should very, very quickly, very early in the process, set the stage for all of us, for everyone who's out there, you know, getting hype out of all these clips, is let everyone know Teddy's in rehab. Teddy will be rehabbing. When something changes with that, we'll let you know. But I hope now that we're, you know, away from the, you know, the off season, and we're really back into, you know, getting ready to play football games, that a lot of the stuff the team's been doing for clicks and all that other stuff by putting Teddy out front and center and making hype videos for him and everything, I hope all that stops now, because for better or for worse, it's Sam's team. And I feel like he needs to get put back out front. If he's the quarterback, he's the quarterback, and let's talk about him and get him out there versus continually having, hey, what's Teddy up to? Teddy's rehabbing. We're not going to hear from Teddy in a while. We're not taking Teddy questions after today. He's rehabbing. When our medical staff has something different to tell you, we'll tell you. But until then, no Teddy questions. So that's where I'm at.
Yep, I agree. I think they should let him answer questions for about 5 to 10 minutes. You know, like Yinka said, Teddy's going to give his typical, you know, dry, simple Teddy answers like he always does. But once they make him open the questions after that session, I think we shouldn't hear from him again until, you know, they activate him whenever they do, whether that's, you know, after the 6-week designation if he is put on the PUP, or whether it's 2018. So we'll see. It'll be interesting to see how they handle it.
I mean, he's going on PUP. I mean, no ifs, ands, or maybes. Like, I get it during the offseason. I get it. Like, I'm a Teddy fan. I love seeing him out there moving around and all the rest, but I mean, he's going on PUP, and I feel like they just need to go ahead and set that expectation for everyone right away, so that the fan base and the team, the locker room, everyone can just coalesce around the players that are playing, so that Sam Bradford isn't dealing with all the nonsense and looking over his shoulder and all that stuff and taking questions about Teddy every other day. Like, I just want them to set that expectation for the media and everyone right away, where we talk about the players who are healthy. The end.
And we'll get an answer.
It might be a thing as far as you know, contract situation as well too. You know, Teddy might not necessarily be the most eager. Like, hey, I just want to go on the PUP for 6 weeks and then I'll come back and, you know, may have a chance to get my job back. So I mean, I think that's also why they're playing it so so close to the chest, and, you know, not necessarily rushing everything. Because, you know, if you come out and say Teddy's going on the PUP right at the beginning of the camp, you know, Teddy might have something to say about that. So, yeah, I guess that's the best mentality.
We'll get an answer next Wednesday. That's when he gets his physical.
Yep, and they're going to say, Teddy, you skipped leg day, so we need you to come over here and do this rehab work. So, anyway, that's where I'm at with it. I feel like we could have a whole nother pod talking about Teddy and the PUP. And all the rumors and conspiracy theories that have popped up on how this is going to get handled and the NFLPA and everything else that might get involved. So I guess we'll write those down and save them for the next ones. But that is it. That's all we got for today. Thank you for tuning in for another episode of the Climbing the Pocket podcast. Ideally, the next time we talk to you, we will have our man, Miles Gorham, freshly back from his honeymoon. He will have picked up his child or his puppy from wherever he went and picked Teddy up from, or chose Teddy before he left. So we'll have the full crew back for you, and may even have a special guest. We'll see. So thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you soon. Have a good one.